is Ideasphere with Betsy Leander Wright, author of Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures.
It's not that there's something wrong with participatory democracy techniques or consensus decision making. To me, the thing that's classist is to come in and say, it has to be done my way because my way is superior. To me, the 100% consensus where anyone can block, those are examples of what I call inessential weirdnesses.
In her book, Missing Class, Betsy Leander Wright looks at class dynamics in 25 groups of social movement organizations. Included in her study, the labor movement, grassroots community organizing, and groups working on global causes in the progressive traditions. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Dr. Betsy Leander Wright, Program Director of Class Action. Dr. Leander Wright makes it a practice to understand the inner workings of social movement organizations. Her previous works include Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists, and she co-authored The Color of Wealth, the story behind the U.S. racial wealth divide. And she joins me for this show. Betsy Leander Wright, thanks for taking this time.
My pleasure, Guy. I'm delighted to talk with you.
I know we can go almost anywhere in this discussion, but what struck me, and I think we need to start here and correct me if I'm wrong, you say that going into various activist groups can feel like entering different worlds. People talk differently, they dress differently, and there are wage conflicts that occur in a different fashion.
Exactly. And I've known this long before I did this study. I knew that as an activist, that when I would walk into, say, a labor union, coalition formed by labor unions, or a community organizing group, or an environmental group, or a globalization group, that these different movement traditions would just do everything differently and would feel often like walking into different worlds, different ways of talking, different preferred group process, different ways of understanding even what activism is. So I looked at that more systematically for the book and found out it's really true, and that those differences are connected with class in two ways. Of course, each movement tradition has its own class roots, like the working class roots of the labor movement or the college-educated professional roots of the environmental movement. But also, it turned out it mattered what the class composition of the group is today. So individuals were bringing the habits, the speech styles of their own class background and class life story into their groups, and having a toolbox created by that, and that our class backgrounds are a resource, but they're also a limitation because there's things we learned and things we didn't learn from our own class life stories.
You said today. The point of that is that things shift and morph so easily depending on who is attending what group.
Exactly. For example, environmental justice groups, they're environmental, but they're largely made up of working class and poor people. And so things are done really differently than in the old-timey conservation and environmental preservation groups. So, yeah, it's of course, it's a shifting class composition. Today's anarchists are not the same as the Spanish anarchists, for example. There's a lot more elite class backgrounds in the anarchists in the U.S. today than in some other eras of anarchism, just to pick an example.
Just the way people laugh is different within groups. And you
right,
notice, yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that. But you say that newcomers are really looked upon suspiciously. They have to prove themselves.
Yeah, I hadn't had all that much personal experience in the anarchist groups, that movement tradition that was actually the fastest growing segment of the left-of-center social movements in the 90s and the O's, the globalization movement and so forth. I made a point of spending a lot of extra time because I didn't know that movement tradition as well as I knew most of the others in the study. I hung with people, I demonstrated with people, and interviewed more than the average. And that was just a real discovery how much people's the habits that come from their own class backgrounds are being amplified by the fears of government infiltrators and of being spied on and prosecuted, which were sometimes justified fears. I did observe mm-hmm. groups that did have actual police spies in the group. So it wasn't that the fears were unreasonable, but this kind of coolness towards newcomers and mistrust, slowness to trust, that is rationalized by, well, unless someone vouches for the new person, that mistrust, which is really understandable, but then feeding in to some things that are their class, but they're also youthful age, being disproportionately white men. There were three different anarchist groups that when I walked in as someone that no one knew my face, no one said hello to me and no one said hello to the other new arrivals. And that didn't happen in any other kind of group. And I thought, oh, there's really something going on here. To have groups where there's not really an understanding that the bonds of the group are going to be built through one-on-one relationships, but the core thing that bonds the group together is shared ideology, shared ideas about politics. And that's what's going to attract new people. That's what's going to keep people active. And that is such a clear class difference with all kinds of groups with second-generation college graduates are in the majority, that you just think that's the bond that's holding people together. The primary bond is to the ideas, the political ideals, the ideology. And there's something fragile about that, because then if you disagree about ideas or ideology, the group can fracture along those lines. In the groups, community organizing and labor groups, where they're either currently or historically is a working class majority, there's an understanding of change through solidarity and unity. And so the primary bond is with the other individuals, and in particular, each member's bond with a trusted leader. That also can be fragile, because then if there's an unaccountable leader or there's a personality clash and a falling out among people, that can fracture the group. And especially these small, low-income community groups seem to have had rift after rift based on people who no longer had that sort of family-like bond with each other. So each form of loyalty, loyalty to ideas or loyalty to particular people, has a fragility to it that can keep groups small or keep groups from succeeding and growing. And so I think that the ideal, if people could learn from each other's activist class cultures, the ideal would be to have some of both. And for college-educated activists to make stronger relationships with individuals and invest more trust in accountable leaders, not be so anti-hierarchy that you pull down anyone who takes leadership in some cases, and for the working class groups to say, even if there's an untrustworthy leader or even if the people stop getting along, the cause is the important thing, and you've got to stick with that. The combination, I think, is when groups are strong.
Program Director, Class Action at classism.org, Betsy Leander Wright. Her new book, Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. You want to tell me more about this work? You have the aspect of your preparation. I don't know if you set out to actually write a book, but in the process of attending so many meetings, you begin to recognize the variety of organizational skills or lack thereof.
I had the idea in 2006. My previous book, Class Matters, I had made this kind of unsubstantiated claim that I thought there were activist class culture differences. And I got a lot of response to that, a short essay in the book Class Matters, just with some anecdotal evidence. And I got more stronger reactions, the class cultures bit, than to anything else in the book. People were asking me to prove it and disagreeing with me, but also being really enthusiastic and wishing I had more concrete specifics about it, or telling me how the class culture differences were in their region or for their race. The enthusiasm of the agreement, the vehemence of the disagreement, I'm like, wow, this is actually a hot topic among people working for social justice. And I thought, well, how would you prove it? What are the activist class cultures? I think it would require a big social science study. It would require some real research where you systematically go get a varied sample of groups, all different movement traditions, different parts of the country, different issues, different sizes, so that you're not seeing something just within one type of group. And then you'd really need to observe how people act and look through the class lens, knowing their class life stories, and then looking at how they talk, how they act in meetings, and when you talk to them, how do they make meaning out of the process of making social change. That really needed that kind of rigor. So it took about 5 years to do, and it was fascinating at every step of the way, and I'm very, very grateful to the 25 groups that we got full data on and to all the people who helped me along the way. And it's like knowing people's class stories and looking at what happens in meetings and interviews through a class lens is like looking at something with 3D glasses and having the patterns pop out. They're patterns that were invisible to me, to my naked eye, because I didn't know what class people were. And most of the people in the groups, they guessed wrong about each other's class a lot. They didn't know the class composition of their own group. They knew it maybe roughly, but they were guessing wrong about at least somebody. So once you know, once you have the class conversations, these patterns pop out that people talk differently, people have different ways of thinking about politics and social change, people have different group process preferences, people have different tastes, use different senses of humor. So many things turned out to be different by class that I really could just write about a few of them. There were so many things that made a class pattern. So I decided to write about the ones that were relevant to solving the most common group problems that everybody who's ever been in a meeting, everybody who's ever been in a voluntary group has, you know, the same complaints. Some people doing all the work and other people being inactive, somebody talking too much, that these the same problems arise no matter what your movement tradition, no matter what your class, sure. The same troubles arise. We could all learn, get some new tools in our toolbox for solving our group's problems if we understood other people's class cultures.
What you show, too, is that sometimes the culture and the difference in class can hamper the movement. I'm thinking about the Occupy Wall Street and how that sort of imploded after a period of time because of the lack of leadership. And then my own experience in seeing the diverse classification, there isn't one. When it came to, years ago, the nuclear power plant activists who were involved.
Yeah, that was my first movement too against nuclear power. And there were times and places where it was cross-class and I was a part of some of that. And there were other times where I feel like all the same class exclusionary practices that I see again today cropping up were being practiced where people were trying to make it into a subculture, where you had to dress a certain way, eat a certain way in order to fit in. And that was leaving out people who didn't want to be part of a subculture, but who didn't want their electric bills to go up or didn't want to live near a source of radiation. So, yeah, I think that movement's a really great example. Occupy Wall Street and all the other Occupies, similarly, there was a lot of cross-class bridging that happened because, of course, homeless people moved into a lot of the encampments and people who had lost their jobs in the Great Recession and so forth. And yet a lot of the initial initiative came from students and college-educated, multi-issue leftists. So there was cross-class bridging going on, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. But again, I saw people make those same mistakes of being too attached to their own subcultural ways of doing things, feeling superior to other activists and insisting on their own counterculture in a way that I personally think is really classist. And I can give you an example. I heard this great story. I wasn't there. I live in Boston. This is New York, which of course was the mothership of Occupy Wall Street. So the May Day Coalition for 2012 in New York City, New York has always had a big May Day march and rally, and the groups that do it year after year are mostly immigrant groups, labor unions, and community groups. Mixed class, but very strong on working class movement traditions. So in 2012, very exciting to have this large potential new constituency, the Occupy Wall Street encampment and their supporters, and seemed like a potential of having a much bigger May Day march. I heard a panel of four people who were involved in the planning, one from an immigrant group, one from a labor union, one from a community group, and one from Occupy Wall Street. And in this panel, someone, this was at Working Class Studies, someone said, "You'll never guess what it was that we argued over so much with the Occupy Wall Street people." And of course, I had just done this research study. The person's about to say group process. And sure enough, the person said, "Group process. Isn't that surprising?" No, well, not to me. It's not surprising at all. So the Occupy Wall Street representatives who were college educated and with very strong egalitarian values against all forms of oppression, all forms of hierarchy, really idealistic, saying, "If you want us to participate, it has to be 100% horizontal." That's their word for a very egalitarian. No hierarchy, no leaders, no one has any more say than anyone else. 100% decision by consensus where everyone has the power to block. This promptly drove insane to the people from the traditional May Day coalition, where people were saying things like, "I have to get home and get my kids to bed. I have to get up and go to work at 6 in the morning." So it's not that there's something wrong with participatory democracy techniques or consensus decision making. Definitely there's groups where those processes work out great. But I think, to me, the thing that's classist is to come in and say it has to be done my way because my way is superior and my way is based on this whole big philosophy and ideology, and to put that primary over, well, how have you all already been doing it? And perhaps we, as the newcomers and the people in many cases more race and class privilege, perhaps we could adapt to your way of doing it and bring up those values gradually, and maybe you'll find some people sharing them, but not to impose. To me, the 100% consensus where anyone can block and the use of hand signals, those are examples of what I call inessential weirdnesses, where there's something you're very, very attached to out of your own subculture, and you're not aware of the ways that your subculture is classed, you know, is coming from a bohemian tradition that's in reaction against an elite background. So countercultures often are that bourgeois bohemian bobo profile, and that everyone else has to do things in my subcultural way. They have to eat my vegan food. I'm going to look down at them if they wear any name brands on their clothes because I feel superior in my used clothes. But that kind of greener than thou is just plain classist. And the being rigid about subcultural traits and your own inessential weirdnesses is a form of classism. And it's not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with used clothes, vegan food, elaborate group processes that make things more, try to share power. I'm not. I like some of those things. It's the rigidity and not seeing that there might be some places where it's inappropriate when you're doing cross-class and or class-race bridging.
Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Betsy Leander Wright. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We're back with Ideasphere with Betsy Leander Wright, Program Director, Class Action, and author of Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures. Differences in others can sometimes make us feel uncomfortable. We don't settle in as easily, and it works on both sides of the classes, as you are showing with more college-educated professionals, as compared to the poorer class people attending the same meeting. They may not as readily speak up.
I wouldn't say all working-class people are quiet. In fact, there's long-standing traditions of more laughter, more freedom to speak while other people are speaking, bluntness, actually thinking it's a negative thing if you hold back out of politeness and fake your sentiments, that you're supposed to be up front. There's some working class norms about frankness and directness that can lead some working class people to be not quiet at all, but actually the person who's going to say the elephant under the carpet may often, in many groups, be working class. So I think saying there's a difference between powerhouse, experienced working class activists who have gotten some strength from prior experiences of solidarity, therefore they're taking leadership or are backing a strong leader, that that's really going to be somebody with different cultural strengths than someone who's very, very disempowered and new to activism and maybe just has been marginalized in so many ways their whole life. It's funny how you can't just do a broad category, working class, middle class, or more privileged, less privileged. Some of the strongest contrasts I saw were on the same side of the class divide, like that one I said about how much people speak up. The quietest and the most gutsy about speaking up could both be on the working class side of the divide.
I think what a reader is going to take away from this is how you use the metaphor. And bypassing the thought of it being a toolkit, you say that it's moving parts, gears, meshes, and grinding, or an interdependent ecosystem.
Right. That I'm a big believer in coalition building because I think we have some huge problems to solve in the society that only a really mass movement that involves enough people to really have a lot of clout is going to have sufficient power to shift some of the fundamental injustices and problems that we see and really turn the big ship around. So I want to see cross-class movements. So that's going to mean in every community and on every issue, some cross-class bridge building. That can be like gears clashing and grinding and catching because people just are different in so many ways, have such different ways of doing things, and are suspicious of each other and or due to classism, looking down and not seeing the great resources in working class and poor activists. For many reasons, cross-class alliances don't happen. When it works, when coalitions work, it's like, ooh, if you have more gears meshing, you generate a lot more power. So, yeah, I think that's a good metaphor.
Betsy Leander Wright, I know we have so much more we can talk about. I haven't overlooked something you think is vital, and if so?
Well, it would be nice if at some point I could tell a story or two. I think there's some funny stories in the book. Well, I guess I did tell about Occupy Wall Street, but none of my stories.
Like Rupert?
You kind of touched exactly. Why would I bring up the fact that this young man wore long underwear without pants to group meetings and horrified other group members by wearing them when representing the group in public, even though they left too little to the imagination? That could seem like I'm just looking for quirky tales to tell. But that actually was a very, very revealing incident about one of the strongest differences about how conflicts are resolved that I found. So a number of people in this group were disturbed by what Rupert was wearing on the bottom half of his body, but they didn't say anything in the whole group, and they didn't say anything directly to him. Instead, they talked behind his back, and they asked a friend of his, a young woman, would she please speak to him? And instead of speaking to him privately, she, in the whole group, she teased him. The next time he wore them to a meeting, she said, dude, you'd wear underwear? You are pushing the limits. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. These are pants. And she's laughing and he's laughing and everybody in the room is laughing. she teased him, and then the next meeting he's wearing jeans. So when you look at that story through a class lens, you discover that the majority of this group is lower professional, mostly young white men. They are college grads, and so are their parents, but not in that elite, confident, upper middle class way. They went to state schools and they have jobs that are in the middle of hierarchies like IT manager. And so lower professionals turned out to be the biggest conflict avoiders. So that thing of talking behind backs, feeling uncomfortable saying things to people's faces, and even speaking about things very indirectly, you know, a little conflict avoidance can be a good thing. I think this, like many class culture traits, has an upside too. They didn't get into too many nasty fights during meetings, but it was conflict avoidance to a dysfunctional degree that I learned that this group had had mismanagement of money that was not brought directly to the person's face either. There were other really heavy things that happened that weren't talked about. Really, it was something that the group needed to change. When you look through a class lens, who was it that they asked? It was their one and only lifelong low-income member. She grew up in poverty, was still among the working poor. So yes, she was a woman and she was his friend, but they kind of knew that she had that cultural competence to deal with things more directly, more bluntly, and through teasing. Teasing as this working-class cultural competence to do it lightly, in a way that draws on familiarity and trust and doesn't offend. Some of them couldn't have pulled that off, what she pulled off. And that was true in so many groups, that there was way more teasing and more immediate, direct, you know, if someone's behavior was out of line, they heard about it immediately in the working class majority group. So her different class culture was a resource to that group. And if they had talked openly about class backgrounds, they would have known more about her background, they might have been able to take some steps towards not being such conflict avoiders and towards dealing with things more directly and maybe even tried out a little teasing to see how that goes if you can do it without offending. So that's like an example of, you know, I just had so many stories that were just entertaining. They were like the kinds of drama and melodrama that happens in groups. It's fun to read about, but you really learn something about what people have taken from their class backgrounds, their class life stories, and both the strengths and the limitations that all of us have from our class conditioning.
And human nature.
Yeah, human nature. We all have a different standpoint, seeing the society, seeing the process of activism and social justice, that comes to us partly from our gender, partly from our race, partly from our geographic area and our generation, but much more than you would expect. Our way of looking at things is distinct to our class life story.
Betsy, it's wonderful speaking with you again. Thank you for your time.
Oh, it's wonderful speaking with you too, Guy.
Missing Class, Strengthening Social Movement Groups by Seeing Class Cultures, Betsy Leander Wright. Check out our website at classism.org. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.